1, 2, 3.
Yeah. When I woke up this morning, I heard this groove in my head. Then I had to get these words out, and then this is what I said. Take out the trash and clean up the litter. I sneak it like a critter. All that is gold is not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. I'm gonna blow up just like the California gold rush. Give us faith, God has a love. We'll be solid as a rock.
All right, and welcome back to another episode of the Traveling Entertainer Podcast. We are back to COVID living episodes where I'm following up with some past guests during these trying times for artists all around the world. Today's guest is none other than Mr. Jim Prescott, a.k.a. Jimmy Jazz, and we had a great conversation about the current state of the music industry. I also got to hear some past tales about touring around the world. He offered up a little perspective on the Japanese audiences versus the American audience, and we talked about some of his run-ins with famous people. Man, do I miss live concerts, and I can't wait until I can get to another live show, and I'm sure the touring artists around the world are chomping at the bit to hit the road again. But until then, to help tide everyone over, here we go with another round of interviews on the Traveling Entertainer Podcast with the one and only Jim Prescott, a.k.a. Jimmy Jazz of G-Love and Special Sauce.
How many times will a man fall on his face to get the girl he wants and take her home to a loving place? For real, I ain't just out here running game. All I need is 15 minutes, a pretty smile, and what's your name? How you feel? You gotta let me know. Do you wanna stay? Yeah, do you wanna roll? What you have a side? It's what I wanna try. And when you're 100 dresses, you know you can't deny. It's a bad, bad world. Don't be a bad, bad girl. It's a cold, cold world. Don't be a cold, cold girl.
Hello, Mike.
Hey, what's up? How you doing, Jimmy?
Good, how are you?
I'm hanging in there, man. I'm doing the best I can to not lose my fucking mind. How about you?
Yeah, man. About the same, you know. You're in Paris now?
Yep. I'm still in Paris, man. I've been here. This is now, I'm almost here for 4 years. We're committed to being here for another year. But it has been, it's been interesting for everybody, right? Like, I think everybody's going through some serious shit over the last couple of months. And it's hard to put words into it, right? It's just fucked. That's the best way I can put it. It's just been a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how are you holding out in Portland? What's it like in COVID-19 Portland time? Riot time as well. I mean, it's messed up.
Yeah, you know, I live in a good neighborhood, man, you know. Yeah, it's pretty comfortable. I'm as privileged as they come, I guess. I really do miss the restaurant scene. I just like realizing how important that was to me, that I didn't really think about it so much before, but other than that, I everything's pretty normal from my perspective, except I'm not working, you know?
Right.
I'm not, and I don't have the prospect of working, in some scenarios ever again. You know, it's like this thing's going to take out a lot of small businesses, and I mean, I hope we're not one of them. And I hope, like, all the places we play, which are, like, largely independent, clubs and venues and bars and whatnot, you know, a lot of those people aren't going to be able to hold on for this. And, you know, if there's not enough of them who have a budget in 2021 to have music, there's going to be a lot of tours. Like, it's freaking me out that, you know, the whole industry might be, like, rarefied to big shows. I don't know, corner bars.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, I think here's the thing is, I think you bring up a really good point that a lot of these small venues that you're playing that are probably holding 1,000 to 2,000 people, those are probably local business owners and they're not owned by Live Nation or anybody huge. Do you actually know of anybody that you have, you know, I don't know if you follow all the places that you perform on, you know, whether they're on Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, or have you seen any evidence to support that some of these small business owners are in fact not going to be opening their doors if live concerts are allowed back?
Not specifically, you know, I mean, that's just basic, you know, I have seen is a lot of restaurants in my area.
Yeah.
Really, all I pay attention to that are, you know, calling it, not returning. You know, I haven't heard anything about the venues here in Portland, but, you know, I know that there's like the jazz venues, they're struggling to hold on. They're trying to like make takeout pizzas, but like people are just holding on if, you know, thinking that they can start having shows again in September or something. But if that's now that that's less likely, I think we're looking at a reevaluation now, but you know, yeah, no, I haven't seen really any direct evidence in the music industry.
Well, you know, hang in there. All right. Well, let's do this. Let's try to, I kind of wanted to use this time. I mean, like, you know, what type of an idiot starts a podcast about traveling the world and then fucking COVID happens, because then nobody's touring and there aren't that many conversations being had about it. But it has been interesting to watch what some larger bands are trying to do. And that's really more a Live Nation thing. Like, I've seen people try to do drive-in concerts, which to me seems like it defeats the purpose 100% of going to a concert to sit in your car. And I think that's just more like, okay, these are the times, let's give it a try, bring a little bit of cash in, somebody wants to perform. But I think the concept is fucking bananas, right? That's not really going to a live concert. To me, live concert is being able to see who's playing and rubbing elbows with your friends and drinking a lot of beer, right? Having a good time. So...
I don't see that relationship. I don't think it's going to work for the musicians either. Like a bunch of people in their cars. Like that's not. That's a weird audience, to say the least. You know.
Yeah, I can guarantee you, I'm not buying a ticket to do any of that. That's just not going to happen.
Right. Exactly.
Like, you know, that is not why I go to see live music. And I'm definitely like, I don't even own a car anymore, so I can't even go to a fucking drive-in concert if I want to. I don't own a car. Well, okay. But let's go back. So I kind of wanted to, you know, I want to use this opportunity to catch up on where we left off and then kind of springboard that into, as a musician, what was it like during that week or two of what's happening? You know, you kind of heard the rumors and how it fell apart, or how you knew this is over for a while, and then, you know, kind of work from there. So the last time that you and I talked, the new record, The Juice, hadn't even dropped yet. There was only the first single had come out, the song Go Crazy. We had a brief conversation about, this was really the first time you'd heard it, and mentioned, well, it sounded different than the way you guys play it live. So what I'm curious is, and we had a little bit of a conversation about, whether or not you thought you'd have to learn all of the songs on the record, because you kind of already been singing along a lot of the songs, you'd already been playing a lot of the songs live that ended up being on the recorded record, like, you know, Drinking Wine. You guys have been playing that forever, and then we finally have a recorded version of it on the new record. So the new record comes out, and now that you've heard it, what's your take on it?
You know, it's pretty groovy. I'm not a huge fan of the production on it. It's a little crispy to me. That's to be expected with Keb Mo. I think we maybe spoke about that before. But you know, like on tour, I was having a lot of fun actually kind of like interpreting his music. It's really like what we would have done, like ideally in the months and times before we go to record. Back in the day, we would like, you know, play the songs on the road, hopefully for, you know, a little while, you know, a couple months, and like work out interesting arrangements and parts. And we were kind of doing that with the record as a demo, so to speak, for our live show. So I was kind of like having fun with that. And we were pulling out like pretty much every week or so, we would add another song. He went one DJ in Colorado, Doug. How quickly they forget. I forget which song, but one of the jams, he's like, let's learn that one. And we were like, yeah, put together our own, you know, live version of it, you know, which was pretty close to it, to the recorded version. Yeah. So I was having fun with that process, and it was kind of like this familiar thing that we would do, kind of just like learn songs on the road. You know, the only difference is this time the record was already done.
Yep.
Which kind of like just took a lot of the pressure off. I just like made it like, oh yeah, we're just going to learn these songs. Like, we don't have to, you know, think about recording them. We can think about like how we want to play them live. And
well, it seemed like a lot of the songs too on that record, and I've got the track list right here. You know, The Juice has been a staple for probably a year in your guys' set. I think Soul BQ had popped up in the set well before it was recorded. Go Crazy. Let's see.
The juice was, that's his solo thing. I mean, that was something that's different. This latest run is that he's doing, you know, he was playing solo. He's doing a solo set out front of like 15 or 20 minutes before the band came out, which is pretty different. Yeah. He was doing a bunch of those as like, just, you know, just that solo. So we didn't play on The Juice. Pretty interesting. I respect him a lot for his creation of his own, his solo thing. It's pretty cool. You know, he's pretty entertaining there, just with his guitar and the harp and everything, you know?
Oh yeah. He's definitely stepped it up a level from what he used to be able to do, I think, solo acoustic. And he's brought it into his own thing. Going back to the original point, though, these other songs that you probably never played before, like there's that song Birmingham on the record, which is a nice little tune. I think Digging Roots is something that you might have played before. Maybe that's a solo acoustic.
No, that was we were just working that. That one we worked out. We were playing that a couple times. I think when all this shit went down, we were just working out Birmingham. And that's pretty much everything. Like, I feel like there's maybe a couple other ones on there that we were going to get to. But, you know, between what he does solo and, you know, songs we already played, we're on track to have the whole record, you know, to be able to play all the songs on the record.
Here you are. Let's cut to the, let's do a little time warp here. Record comes out. You guys always are touring when you can, and usually, you know, there's a new record every couple of years coming out. So the record drops. You guys usually go out and do your own.
Yeah, we dropped the record in January or something, so that we would be touring for the record.
And it sounds like you got you did a lot of the West Coast, right? I remember I was about to fly back to Seattle.
No, we do this tour every year. We do like a month on the East Coast and a month on the West Coast with the middle, you know, interspersed. We started in January up in Milwaukee or someplace up there, played Minnesota all around, and went over to the Northeast and then down to Florida. We blew off Texas because we already played in Texas one show, and then we went home for a little while, and then we went back out to Colorado, played in Colorado, and then Southern California, and then, we were on our way north when all this shit went down.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Three quarters of the way through our usual tour.
Right. Three quarters, well, that's pretty good. That's better than a lot of other people. I mean, I really feel sorry for is all these people that had records planned to drop. Right. And, you know, decided, well, let's still put the record out because we put our heart and soul into it. But then the touring doesn't happen. And it's like, you know, I think somebody has to ask this question. Like, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's around, can they hear it? It's like, if a record gets released during COVID, does anybody buy it? Right. Like, if you can't tour off of it, is there, unless you're, you know, backed by a massive label, is it even worth releasing? You know, I don't know. There have been a few releases that have come out in the last couple of months that I've really, really enjoyed, and I can't wait to see them live. But, you know, I can't think of a lot of artists out there that have that sort of clout that can drop a record and not tour and be okay with it. But here's the point. So I'm guessing you were in California, and you guys are touring up a new record. How are the audience sizes? How is the audience like reacting to the new music? Was it business as usual? Were you finding that the audience was really liking the new stuff?
Yeah. The new stuff was getting a good reaction. People were digging the show. You know, I think G-Love had consciously tightened up the show. You know, I said he was playing solo at the beginning of the set. It was kind of instead of playing at the end of the set when, you know, because he didn't want people leaving. And he wanted, it would get too long if he played, like, solo at the end of the set. So he put the solo stuff at the beginning of the set. And then, you know, we were playing, like, with that, like, under, you know, definitely under 2 hours a night. And, like, usually right around the, you know, 110 minute mark or something. It's like this kind of natural point where you're kind of done.
Right.
And I think the show was really good. People were psyched. We had a great show up in Telluride. I don't know if you've ever been up there, man. That's like one of the most beautiful places in the world.
So what is it that's so nice about it? Beyond, is it just the scenery, or is the venue nice, or is it the town? Is it
It's kind of a trifecta. It's a beautiful spot on the planet. Like, it's amazing. And then this was like cool little town. The venue is like this old, you know, I forget what it's called. It's like the Arts Center or something. It's really sweet. And the people are all, you know, super into it too, because they don't get a ton of shows up there, you know. And it was really beautiful and really great. Me and Gary went skiing that day. Yeah, that's a top end spot, man. And we had good shows in Colorado, and then we played a casino up in Tahoe, I think. And then we're down in San Diego, the Belly Up, where we usually play down there. And that was a couple days out. I remember I was trying to help out with the ride or some shit, and they were like, oh, we couldn't. And that we wanted a pack of toilet paper from the bus, and couldn't get your toilet paper. So I was like, what? And then that night, that was a sold-out show. You know, that show always sells out. Sometimes we do two nights there. And then, I guess, you know, three-quarters to a half of the people showed up, and people are starting to be pretty freaked out, including G-Love. He's a little hypochondriacal. A little bit. Mm-hmm. He was like, what are all these people doing? You know, it's like, I can't believe it. And, you know, some friends of mine came out there, and we were like, are we going to hug? And I was like, we're going to hug. Fuck it. You know? And this was like way before masks or anything. And then, we played a couple more shows. We played another two nights or no, maybe it was just like, the next night. We heard that was the last night in San Luis Obispo. We're like, we're going to play tonight, play this show, and then everyone's flying home the next day. So I was like, what?
So who made that decision? Was it pretty much, was this just a universal thing that was happening across America? Like, there was a, or was it a state decision? Like, California was like, we're done. You know, everybody on the West Coast. Keep in mind, I was in Paris at the time. I had my own personal shit going on, and I wasn't paying attention to what was going on in the concert scene. But
no, it was simultaneously. So that was like Monday or Tuesday, the NBA said they weren't going to play. They were like, the NBA suspended all games, all practices, everything. And that was a big hit. People were like, what? And then, so on that day, like the day before, we were like, oh, this is, you know, something's going to happen. Like the NBA, and we had a show in Canada. We're like, we're not going to go to Canada because we may not be able to get back in, right? And it's like, but we should, you know, try and finish out the tour. Yeah,
and guessing,
then,
I guess that door got probably closed
Seattle,
within the next day or two as well,
Seattle
right?
Banned, you know, also Seattle banned gatherings of more than 50, so that forced that show to close.
Yeah.
And that was a big hit. That's like a big linchpin show for the tour. And then I think, you know, Oregon and, yeah, I think that was like they banned like gatherings of more than 50 for that Saturday. Then that, like that same night, which was like Thursday, AEG and Live Nation announced together that they were canceling everything. And
right.
They pulled the whole touring down across the whole country.
So what were you thinking when that all happened? Were you thinking, oh, this is just
holy fuck?
That's probably the best way to put it. Did you think it was going to last this long? Did you think it was like, all right, we got through the tour, we'll be back online, or you know, we'll be back soon enough, or is it just sinking in over time? Holy fuck, even more and more.
I mean, it was really, I mean, you know, when we went off, they postponed shows for 3 months, which was just like, oh my god, that's crazy. And then we were like, oh, like it's not realistically going to come back until, you know, July, August. And then people are saying this, and I'm thinking, that's no, like that's it's this is going to be like, I was just thinking like the economic hit is going to, you know, be hard. And but Garrett's going to try and until a couple days in, then they're like, you know, yeah, we're not working till October now. That's a cruise.
Oh God, you guys would sign up for a cruise, really? Is that like the
the blues, the new rhythm and the
yep.
same
yeah, you guys
rhythm
have,
and blues.
I've heard some live sets off that. I know you guys are kind of, you know, you've done it year after year, and I think it's probably a lot of fun for you guys as well. But do you? I mean, I get worried.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you get scared being on a cruise ship nowadays? Because that fucking scares me, man.
Yes.
I'd rather rub elbows at the Showbox or the Crocodile Cafe for a couple of hours than be on lockdown with a bunch of people from all over the world. Like, I'd have no problem going to a live concert right now.
Yeah.
If they'd open the fucking doors, I'd buy a ticket and I'd be there. But a cruise ship? Ooh, I'd have to think twice about that one.
I know. Yeah. It's, you know, given, like, if it was next week, I would be like, no. But I think by October, I think there's going to be, well, I don't know. I can't tell you what I'm going to think. Like, I have my moments where I'm like, fuck, maybe I will never get on a plane again. Because that's the other big one. I was like, I don't want to go on those fucking planes. I never liked that shit to begin with. And now it's like, it's like roulette.
Did you notice at the end of this, when this thing got called, did you notice the audience thinning? And were you guys like, wait, we sold this many tickets, but these many people showed up. Like, is this going to be a new thing?
Just that one show. Just the one show. Maybe the next night, too. Yeah, the two nights, like, when it was all going down, I think it was like a Tuesday night. Maybe we had a night off or something, a weird Wednesday night off or something. And then, then the next show was scheduled. Before that, it was like, there was no, I don't recall any reaction at all. Everyone, you know, sold out shows were full. You know, people weren't not coming to shit they bought a ticket to.
Did you notice anybody in the audience starting to wear a face mask? Was that a thing for a moment, or was it not even something you saw?
No. In fact, right, at that time, the discussion on the face mask was you weren't supposed to wear a face mask unless you were sick. So I don't think people were wearing face masks in general.
Yeah, and I don't think...
Unless you're like a medical worker or sick.
I think culturally wise, too, America isn't the place that people wear masks. It's just not something that they do unless they're like protesting, bank robbing, or rioting. But I mean, it's rare that you're just on public transportation.
Well,
you know, if you're on public transportation, it's very uncommon to see Americans in masks. Not to mention, there's not the best of all public transportation in America. But that's not what I'm here to talk about as well. But you know, you go to some place like Japan, and that's culturally acceptable, or they've been wearing masks for a long time due to whatever it is there, pollution, you know, viruses, things like that. But I think it's more common in other countries to adapt to these masks, which is also why we had no fucking masks when we needed them, right? We gave them to other countries.
Yeah, it's definitely more common in Asia, and I think we're learning that the reason is because they've dealt with this shit before, and it's like they're more prepared for hurricanes too. It's like that's just part of what they do, and they did all this with SARS, and you know the other shit.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, you look at Japan when they had the tsunami that hit, I mean, just the devastation that went on over there, and that caused a whole bunch of other problems. But anyways, you know, actually, let's get off the negative tip, because that's just fucking depressing.
Okay.
Yeah, one of the things I kind of wanted to talk to you about was, since you have been around the world, you know, and Japan is one of the staples that you guys end up going to, what's it like when you're performing in front of an American audience versus a Japanese audience? And I very well know what to expect when it comes to an American audience. And interestingly enough, I've been to 47 countries, but Japan is not one of them. I was supposed to be in Japan last month. The family and I were going to go over there on a vacation, but that got fucked. But it made me start thinking, like, you have this built-in fan base in Japan, and it seems like every year, every other year, you guys go there and play, oh, I don't know, 3 to 6 shows maybe. So what's it like performing in front of a Japanese audience versus an American audience?
The Japanese really know how to listen. They're really great listeners. And Americans don't seem as concerned with listening, you know? And there's other aspects of the show that are more important to Americans. I feel like, yeah, there's, you know, the culture of Japan, it's interesting. Well, the story I always tell is, like, the first time we played there in Japan, first off, we were, like, greeted like the Beatles at the train station, like, with groupies running up to us and shit. We were like, what? It was hilarious. But then we go and play this beautiful club. You know, everything's all perfect. And we go out and we go to, you know, start playing. And they introduce us. This polite applause. And then it's, like, dead quiet. You can hear a pin drop. Which is something that you almost never hear in an American club or venue,
so,
usually.
Are you saying when you go to a show in Japan, somebody comes out and announces, you know, and here comes G-Love and Special Sauce. You guys walk up on the stage. Are they clapping or are they just dead silent? You start playing and then they clap after a song?
No, normal. They applaud you when you come onto stage. But then, like, as if it's like a symphony concert, they'll sit quietly and wait for you to start.
Saying they don't drink a lot of beer and
not
talk to their friends during the concert
like
I do?
Bar, talking to the friends. You know, in America, we're like 3 songs in, and people are like, hey, there's a band.
Yeah.
But in Japan, also the shows are very expensive over there. It's like, you know, 2 and 3 times as much. And people, they come see you because you don't get over there that often. So they're like, really put a lot into the show, so it's more than I think it's more of a intellectual kind of, or it's like a more important experience to them than it is to American audiences, and that's just the way it's structured, and it's totally fine. I mean, I don't mind playing. I like playing clubs where people are like having a good time. You know, I think that's part of actually like part of our sound and part of our learning process. And, like, working for that attention and getting the attention of American people is rewarding. But when the Japanese people follow you, and, like, there's one show we played. It was at the Fuji Rock Festival, which is the greatest, hands down the greatest, you know, rock music festival out there. Largely because it's the Japanese people who know how to behave themselves. But, man, we were playing in a tent there, like the Red Stage or something. And it was amazing. It was like one of the most incredible experiences of my life. It was like everyone in the whole audience. There must have been, you know, 2,500 people there, like all completely engaged with like every note we were playing and like reacting. And, you know, they're like so quiet to start. And then when you get them going and when they're really excited, it's super rewarding. And it's an amazing, like, trippy psychedelic experience, man, you know, because that energy from the crowd and your interaction with it, yes, that's what it's all about, man. That's what it's all about. Right.
So who, it sounds like, would you prefer a Japanese audience over an American audience any day of the week? Or is it, you also like the, you know, I'm guessing the Japanese not drink as much at a G11 special spa show as the Americans do.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It's, I don't know. I can't answer that. I think,
both of them are good for different reasons.
They're both unique because of the contrast. The contrast is interesting, but I can't say that one is better than the other, except the rewards and possibilities are much more available when people are paying attention. It's like hard, it's like superficially harder work to engage, you know, American audiences, you know.
I don't actually, because I've never been on stage playing, dude.
So, like, I'm like a contrasting, like, polar opposite experience to that, you know, one in Japan. Was when, you know, we were playing at the, you know, some one of these Midwestern festivals for, you know, hosted by, there's like a jam band festival. And, you know, there's all different bands going on. And, like, we're playing our set. And, you know, halfway through our set, you know, we can hear, like, a really loud DJ in the stage way behind us starts playing. And he goes off, and you can just see people, like, looking at their watches or their phones or whatever, like, oh, that's something else I want to see. Like, walking away, like, a whole second half of the set, basically, people are just, like, walking away. It's like trying to, you know, you think you're just playing the song, but it's like you're in, like, this mud of just, like, negative energy because it's leaving.
Yeah.
That was, like, yeah, that's something that would not happen in Japan because people are too polite. If they were going to leave in the middle of your show, they wouldn't go to your show in the first place. It's kind of like a etiquette that is completely lacking.
Well, especially in festivals, too, because I've been to a million festival shows in America, and that you're right. That's exactly what it is. When you hear somebody else you like, you're, like, running towards that as quickly as possible. And probably, you know, not thinking too much about the poor feelings of the artist on stage.
Yeah. Well, it's also, like, terrible scheduling, and you know, sometimes people play, I don't know, sometimes there's not a tremendous amount of thought or even ability, like, because of people's scheduling, and they want to get particular names, like, so if you have a multi-day festival with multiple stages, it's inevitable you're going to play two acts against each other that, you know, majority of people want to see them both, and you can't do that. It's, you know, it's hard to manage that.
So how do you feel about festivals in general? Because, like, you know, I figured you guys have been tried and true. You've been around. You can,
you know,
go to a venue of 1,000 or 2,000 people and make a tour out of it all across America. But in the summertime, these festivals show up. Do you guys prefer festivals or do you not? Or does it even matter? Are you just going to take the gig?
I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, it sucks to be inside, and a lot of club venues won't do a lot of shows in the summertime. They do, it's kind of like school year oriented. So there's a culture and
season, like, if you will.
A season, yeah. A season, like August should be festivals and whatnot. You know, it's such a broad category, it's almost meaningless, right? Because
right.
there's festivals here in town that are just like curated shows at 10 different venues. And then there's, like, the Fuji Rock Festival, which is, like, an amazing cultural institution just about, you know.
So how big is this festival? Because I've never been to it. Like, how big of a stage?
I mean,
and how, is it, like, a three-day festival? Is it massive? I know that, like...
Three-day festival. I'm not sure, like... I mean, it's one of the major rock festivals. I think they might have just canceled this year or something, but... It's there's like 7 or 9 stages, the biggest acts in the world. It's in the, you know, 5 figures per day I'm guessing 6 figures over the 3 days of separate people. It's held where the Nagano Olympics were.
Gotcha. So it's huge.
It's giant. People camp out. There's like huge camping for the people. There's like the ski bowls. This is one of my favorite aspects of it. It's like the ski, each ski bowl kind of area is a giant stage, or like depending on how big the bowl is. So it's like, you know, kind of around this foothill of the mountain, there's, you know, all the stages. So the stages are like sonically separate by mountains, you know, and big hills.
Cool.
I mean, it's a massive festival to get around. Sure, it's like if you were to do it, you'd, I mean, the Japanese people have it all planned out, and there's like apps, porta potties are high end. But yeah, it's a great physical, you know, geometry. And yeah, the Japanese people are so cool. They like behave themselves. Like one of the first times I was over there, we were like on this trail through an art walk in the woods, you know, and it's like the woods, and it's like these hanging lights, and you know, there's, you know, 50,000 people in this place, and yet it's like quiet. There's a lot of people there, but they weren't like running off in the woods, pissing everywhere. And I was like,
I've never done that.
That was like shortly after. That was shortly after we were at Woodstock '99, with, you know.
Is that, by the way? Let me ask you this. Is that the biggest audience you've ever played in front of? Because I know that you guys, you have the claim to fame, if I'm right, is you are the only band that's ever played two sets at a Woodstock event, right? Didn't you guys have a normal set, and then someone was able to show up like fucking whatever.
Yeah,
what was the name of that goddamn band that I hate them? They sucked. Anyways, but you guys ended up getting
Everclear?
The second. Was it Everclear?
I don't know. I don't know who it was.
I thought it was that those guys that had that one hit wonder song that's like, all around the world, thank you, travel for me. What the fuck is their name? That dude like Mark McGrath. God, they were just a horrible, horrible band. Anyways, but for anyone who listens to this who doesn't know this, G11 Special Sauce are the only band in the history to play Woodstock twice, one in a small stage, and then you got thrown up on the main stage. And that must have been a huge
concert. That's right.
That's like how many thousand? 50,000? 65,000 people there? I mean, that's a big audience. And that must have been, like, what was that like, being that young, touring off your first record, and all of a sudden being in front of an audience that big?
It was insane, dude. There's so much. It's going to be a whole chapter in my book, man. But I tell you, it was fucking disturbing what was happening in the audience. I just got to tell you, like, it was like a melee for 50 yards out of people. It looked like the fucking cartoons when there's like they're having a cartoon fight, and it's like the smoke with just like fists and body parts coming out.
Yikes.
People were like struggling for their lives there. You know, I felt
right.
Like I was like, why am I playing music? Like, this seemed really stupid. And you know, there's a camera, and every time the camera would come down and point at the audience, they'd go wild at the camera. Like, have nothing to do with us. And it was just like, it was a fucking spectacle. We're following James Brown. We like went after James Brown. He just like tore the place up. And people were like, went crazy. By the time we went on, it was just like this melee in front of us that was like.
That's fucking
and
awesome.
Then I looked out,
first of all, wait, hold
right
on a second.
I
have to cut you off.
It was weird.
You went after James Brown. Like, you got to watch James Brown set and then go,
yeah.
Are you kidding me? We've got to go on after this guy?
I think it was Dana Carvey introduced us and got, like, pelted with shit. He got pelted with water bottles. And, like, Chris D, you know, our friend there, Chris D, he was like, Dana Carvey, I'm going to get his autograph. And it's like, goes up to him, and he's, like, on the side of the stage, he's in tears because he was trying to introduce the band, and he got pelted with. But it wasn't Dana Carvey. Maybe similar looking dude.
Right.
Like a comedian guy. It's like, why did they help this guy? It's just because it's like, you know, it's like until the people are like 75 yards out, like then people were just like sitting on their blankets like nothing's happening. But it was like this bedlam in front of us. That's got to be one of the weirdest gigs I ever played.
Yeah, and you can see it too. If you YouTube it, it's there. Like, that whole gig is widely available for you to watch online. But is that the biggest audience you've ever been in front of?
Yeah, I guess if you're counting, I mean,
it's a big fucking audience. I mean, there's nothing wrong
with it,
right?
We played big audiences at Fuji Rock. We played a real big audience first couple of years. We would play these festivals over in Europe. We played the Puka Pop Festival. I think we were early in the day on that one. And it was, you know, I don't know if people were there. We played in front of big audiences at the festival in England. What is that one fucking called? Glastonbury. Yeah, the Glastonbury festival.
Glastonbury is massively huge. I mean, that thing's just ridiculous. But I've heard everyone that's been there, like, you know, they've had a really good time. But it's just the same old thing. It's a festival. So, you know, it comes with, like, especially Glastonbury, because that's out on some farm. It just comes with mud and stink and filth and no place to go to the bathroom. And, you know, it's like
1 year.
It's like going to war and coming out in a couple of days and you might be pregnant. Who knows, right?
Very much so. Very much so. 1 year we flew in. I think we flew in for that festival. And we got on the plane, they're predicting rain, and we got off the plane, and they were like, "We think they're going to cancel your gig." It's like, they're going to close that stage. And we were like, what? And then they weren't going to close it. And then they were, and we drove out there, and we drove right from the airport to out to Wales, or wherever the fuck this place is. And as we're getting there, they decided that the rains had stopped, and the band before us was going on, who was Stereo Lab. This had to be, maybe in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s. Anyhow, yeah, and this, they had, like, stabilized the stage, I guess, and, like, with some wood things. And so, like, the area where the stage was, you could see it was, like, in the field, and it was, like, a sea of mud. And we were in a splitter van with all of our gear, and we have to drive down this, like, it's like railroad ties, but they're just beneath the surface of the mud sea.
Right.
So the driver's like driving along, and he can't see where the railroad ties are. And he's like trying to get somebody to like just walk on the railroad ties in front of me so I can see. Like everyone's like, what? So he's driving, and like we're about 30 yards from the stage, and the damn splitter van slips off the things, and we're stuck there. And we're like, we're not running with our gear through that mud, like, the amphitheater shit, and like, it's all this crazy, we're like, oh my God, we come so close. And then, like, right at the last minute, this like, tractor comes barreling down and, like, hooks up the front of us, pulls us over the stage, and, Stereo Lab finished up, we went up there, played a show, you know, triumphant, you know, you get so emotional after that, you know, the journey. And the people were, like, totally, totally soaked and so into it. We played a really great show. And then we got back in Splitter Van. Actually, then me and Houseman ended up smoking a joint with Joe Strummer.
What? These are the reason. These are the podcasts.
Really?
Like, this, who cares about the traveling aspect? You smoked a joint with Joe Strummer. Are you kidding me?
Well, we kind of stood around in a circle, like, you know, somebody, our guitar tech who was from over there, Sarge, was like, hey, go over here, Joe Strummer's sitting there. And he was apparently sitting there with a bunch of British comedians and shit, and they're all telling stories, and I tell you, I can't really remember it very much. Jeff reminded me of it the other day, and apparently Joe Strummer was like trying to tell me about this book about El Salvador or some shit.
Yeah.
It was a trip. And then our tour manager came over and was like, the fucking band's leaving! God! You know? That's how every story of my life ends. And then the tour manager came and started screaming at me.
No, but that's, I mean, look, we're digging a little bit deep in this conversation, but watching James Brown play a living legend and then playing after him, I mean, Joe Strummer,
yeah,
that's not somebody that, like, I mean, that would be high up on the list of, like, oh, yeah, I'd start introducing myself around town, being like, hi, my name is Jimmy Jazz, oh, yes, and I smoked a joint with Joe Strummer, what have you done, right? That's what I would do.
I did that and then forgot about it for 10 years.
there's a liability issue if you smoke a joint with Joe Strummer that you might forget about things for a very long time. But what about, is there anybody else on your bucket list of like artists that you met that you were like, I can't believe I met this person? Or is there people that you have come across that you've just been blown away how you know, how much they've influenced you in your life, or is there anybody out there that is,
well,
I wanted to meet him and I got to meet him or her?
I never really was trying to meet everybody. Like, you know, Dr. John surprised me. He was really nice, really nice dude. And yeah, he was like a legendary person, you know.
Didn't he play on one of you guys' records?
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
He played on Yeah, After That Easy, right?
Yeah, we performed together on our only appearance on the Dave Letterman show. We were with Dr. John. It was very cool.
When was that? What song was that?
Stepping Stones, I believe it's a song. If I'm not mistaken.
I'll look it up. And if you're wrong, I'm going to keep it in the podcast. If you're right, I'm editing that shit out.
look it up on YouTube, dude. Look up the Dr. John G Love and Special. There's actually a reel that came out after Dr. John passed of all Dr. John's performances on The Tonight Show. He was a frequent guest, and we're one of those performances.
Yeah, I got to find that. That's cool.
Back when he passed. I can't really think of too many other people who Billy Gibbons sat in with us once. That was fucking awesome.
Yeah, but that guy's badass. Billy Gibbons is the fucking man.
Yeah, he's and super, super cool, super nice guy.
It's okay if there are more, Jim. I'm literally going to get off this whole podcast now. It doesn't matter just because you told me about Joe Strummer. You got to smoke a joint with Joe Strummer. Like, that's just like... Okay, I mean, that might be one of those moments in your career where you just sort of look over at your group and be like, I think we're done now, right, guys? We've accomplished what we needed.
Yeah, you know, I have like a weird guilt about it because I didn't really remember it for years. Like, it's like, I don't know. I was like, how did I miss that? Why didn't I, like, I don't know.
I don't know, man. Maybe you should have been taking your ginkgo biloba at an earlier age.
Yeah. Or taking notes or like journaling or something. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Well, anyways, it's still a great story. And even if it's not factual,
it's
who
a
cares?
Story, yeah, man.
So let me ask you a couple other questions. Let's just assume, let's go back to the whole what the fuck is going on in your life. Let's say all of a sudden, a month from now, they start saying, okay, to go back to concerts. How quickly could you guys put together a tour? Like, if you were like, look, we got to get out there and make some fucking money, how fast would you guys be able to get your booking agent to be like, book us 15 shows now?
Definitely. They won't do anything before October.
No, but that's not the point. The point is, how quickly, when you guys need to put together a tour, what's that timeline from the date, you know, you go, booking agent, go book? And then you book
these
shows.
They start arranging the December tour at, you know, as soon as they finish their festival in August. So, or the January tour. So it's like 4 months lead time is probably
a reasonable amount of time to book a tour.
That's normal. Well, that's normal time.
Yep.
You know, if it was just us, you know, I'm sure things could be arranged. But the whole rest of the touring industry is going to be trying to do makeup tours. You know, like shows this fall probably already scheduled and, you know, are going to be canceled or not. And, you know, venues, yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, I don't think you're going to see live music in the States until October.
So it would take you 4 months to plan a tour, but even if they open it up, do you think that time could be, I assume, since these are not normal times, as soon as all of these states start saying, yes, we will have live, you know, shows predicted in August or September, October, I'm assuming you guys are going to be like, yes, we will start playing again. Does that sound reasonable? Like, you guys want to get out and start playing?
You know, I do. I do. I can tell you that for sure. I don't know. About,
so who doesn't want to out of your – I mean, you guys got a small group, right? Like, there's five or six of you on a bus.
Yeah, I mean, it's not up to me. It's up to Garrett, and you know, if they can, you know, and if the agent Aaron Pincus down in Texas, if he can put something together for us, you know, G's going to do it. But I'm not sure that the offers are going to be there, right? Because that's how they do it. They got to say, oh, you know, the agent has like X number of bands available, and then the clubs go to him, and they're like, oh, we want this guy on this date, and it's a really complicated process.
Yeah.
That process is screwed by uncertainty. I think Garrett will be doing solo shows before the band. I'm sure everybody associated with the band needs to make money, his manager not, you know, included. So they're all going to want him to get out there and be earning, but maybe not me and Jeff.
But that's also just the uncertainty. I mean, you know, you don't know that for sure yet. It makes a lot of sense what you're saying, but hopefully, I think at the same time, like, there's going to be a healing process. Like, people are going to want to get out again. And so hopefully as soon as they open it up to live concerts, there's going to be a lot of artists that are like, sure, I'll get in my car right now. Like, you know, we'll do it. But how the hell do I know? I don't know. I'm in Paris. And I'm not that smart, Jim. Just so you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a lot made of the pent-up demand.
Well, so let me ask this, too. Why don't you get in the studio and record new songs? Wouldn't this be a good opportunity for you guys to just jump into the studio and put a bunch of songs that you've had together so that 6 months from now, a year from now, you'd have a new release already in the can? Or is that just like, is that crazy talk and I'm a fucking idiot?
Yeah, well, you know, it's expensive talk. I mean, I'm doing that on a personal level. There's expense involved if you want equitable, you know, back in the day, you got, you know, money for recording.
Right.
Got advances and whatnot.
You guys used to record, I think the last couple of records were down at the, I think it's called the Power Plant down in California, Jack Johnson's solar-powered recording studio. What would it cost?
Yeah.
How much
did
that cost you guys to bang that out? And it seems like your process there was quite quick because you're, you know, tried and true band, you know what you're doing, and you could put a record together in a week. What is the cost of that? Like, how much money does it cost G11 Special Sauce to go out and put together 10 songs?
I don't think Jack charged us anything in the studio. That's the thing. It was a very small amount.
Just covering overhead.
The engineer had to be paid. I mean, maybe there was a base rate. I have no idea, to be honest with you. Well, that's part of my thing on the whole, like, music industry is, like, going into this, it was a house of cards that was built on the back of, you know, creative people who don't get their share. And I don't know how you're going to rebuild that system. It's like it needs to be rebuilt some other way. You need to fund the arts in a different way across the board. You need to fund a lot of our society differently. It's the beginning of the summer. Hurricane season has already been one hurricane. It's going to be a long summer, man. It's going to be a long summer.
But here's the thing is, you're in a band that has a long history behind it with a huge fan base. You know, when I was kind of alluding to, well, what if you got down to like a 2 month period? You might be able to be, because you're very well known, you guys are respected, you can hit the road, they expect a turnout. You know, you it's business, right? You guys, you show up on time, you perform your ass off, and you get the fuck out, and you go to the next gig. I would think a band like you would be able to jump back and put a tour together faster than any other band out there. Does that sound crazy?
Well, that just may be. We are nimble.
And that is the end of another episode of the Traveling Entertainer Podcast. A million thanks to Jim Prescott for being on the program again, and I hope that the band hits the road as soon as possible. Man, Joe Strummer, that was super cool. If you have any questions or comments, drop us a line at info@travelingentertainer.com, yes, with two L's in traveling. And if you like what you heard, you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn plus Alexa, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, pretty much everywhere podcasts are hosted, or you can stream it off the website at www.travelingentertainer.com. In the meantime, until the world gets back to normal, support musicians in any way you can, and please check out Jim's solo work released on Bandcamp, which you can find at www.jimmyjazz.bandcamp.com. We've got more interviews coming soon on the Traveling Entertainer podcast, and our next guest will be Opie Ortiz from the Long Beach Dub All-Stars. Take care, everyone, and safe travels.